Notice the return of spirituality to science. Psychotherapist Mark Epstein is well known for mapping the ways in which Buddhism can enrich Western approaches to psychology. Though definitely not an evangelist trying to convert people to Buddhism, he's written extensively on Western psychology and I would say widened and deepened it with his meditation. With whimsical titles such as Advice Not Given, A Guide to Getting Over Yourself, or Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart, and Thoughts Without a Thinker, his books are playful yet astute, wise without pretense. I had a wonderful conversation with a very humble Mark and at the end felt deeply lifted.
Mr. Mark Epstein, you are a psychiatrist, a therapist, a Buddhist and a beautiful writer with a predilection for the understatement. On my wall I have one of your quotes, "Happiness is the ability to receive the pleasant without grasping and the unpleasant without condemning." I read that one of the first quotes that inspired you to Buddhism was, "Look to your mind, wise man, it is subtle, invisible, and treacherous." That gave me a big laugh. Can you tell us a little bit about your start in meditation and how important it is to you in all of your roles?
Yes, of course. I love that you picked up on that quote from the Dhammapada. That's from the Dhammapada.
Right.
A collection of Buddhist verse meant for lay people, you know, not for monastics.
Right.
And I read it in my freshman year in college. I took an introduction to world religion class because I had met a girl who was taking that class. I had no interest in religion at all, but I had an interest in her. And I happened into this class, and the whole first semester was Eastern thought, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Taoism. And we read that text, the Dhammapada, and there's a chapter about mind, the nature of mind. And that phrase that you picked up on really touched me. Because it was all talking about, you know, how precious the mind is, how unknown the mind is, and how what a great potential there is to transform the mind through meditation, basically. So that that oriented me towards meditation. And a couple of years later, I was fortunate enough to meet some of the first Americans who were bringing Buddhist meditation back to America from Asia, from India and Thailand. Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and Ram Dass.
Wow.
Who was originally named Richard Alpert. I met them all.
Wow. That's all the Western...
I was still in college. A couple years.
Yes, sorry, Mark. I was just about to say that's all the Western Buddhist luminaries, isn't it?
They became that when I met them. They seemed pretty luminous. They were still young, but they were you know 10 years, or Ram Dass's case, 20 years older than me. So they seemed all grown up, even though they were, you know, Jack and Joseph were not quite 30 years old, I think, when I first met.
And can you tell us a little bit of how that unfolded for you? I mean, really, Ram Dass and Sharon Salzberg, all those people, I've read a lot of them and been inspired so much by their writings and their story.
Well, I felt very fortunate to get to know them all personally. They became friends as well as teachers. So any tendency that I had to idealize them, you know, as some kind of a superhuman people who had transcended their personalities, that was immediately eliminated. You know, I saw them, I knew them as real people struggling with their own issues. And in some kind of perverse way, that gave me permission to struggle with my own issues and not to feel that meditation, which became very important to me, but not to feel that meditation had to make me into a different person, but that it actually had to help me be myself. And I feel very lucky about that because I could see many other people, you know, sort of going down the wrong path with it, feeling that they had to eliminate, you know, aspects of themselves instead of grow into themselves. So I studied pretty intensively as much as I could the meditation stuff. Did a lot of retreats and traveled to Asia with them, with Jack and Joseph and Ram Dass, meeting their teachers as much as I could. But then I went to medical school with the idea of becoming a psychiatrist, which was not that fashionable in those years, even among people going to medical school. Wanting to become a psychiatrist, I think I was one of two in my class at Harvard Medical School who had that agenda. But I felt like I had gotten something from meditation and from Buddhism that I hoped I could bring to the practice of psychiatry, to therapy, because it had helped. I saw how it had helped me, but also how I still needed therapy. So I wanted to try to integrate that in my own life. And then, you know, in the past 30 or 40 years, I've been trying to integrate it in my work as a therapist and then later in my writing. So, you know, that kind of brings you up to date.
Has meditation turned out to be a bit of a therapist for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I keep learning from meditation, and I keep returning to it to remind me of what it's already shown me, and to, you know, open up new areas of exploration for myself. And so personally, it's remained very important to me. I try to go at least once a year for a week to this place in Massachusetts where I can do intensive practice. It's kind of set up, a branch of the Insight Meditation Society that's set up to promote intensive practice. But I've also tried to bring it in a more subtle way into my work as a therapist, where I'm not trying to lay a Buddhist thing or a meditation thing on my patients, but to what extent is possible, I've been trying to, you know, infuse my work as a therapist with whatever kind of understanding I've been able to glean from the more intensive practice of meditation for myself. So it's been an ongoing, effort on my part.
Fantastic. You've written as well that meditation is not a means of forgetting the ego. It is a method of using the ego to observe and tame its own manifestations. And that seems to be a lot of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I found there was a lot of confusion in the Buddhist world, among Westerners in the Buddhist world, around this issue of ego, even what the word means. You know, what I was trying to figure out in my early writings was the ego that the psychoanalysts and the therapists were trying to shore up. You know, was that ego the same ego that the Buddhists were trying to take down? A friend of mine, Jack Engler, who's another Buddhist therapist, he had a phrase in the 80s, you know, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody, that I spent a lot of time, you know, arguing with and then supporting. I've gone all around on it. But one of the conclusions that I've come to that I got from my friend Robert Thurman, who's a Buddhist professor at Columbia, was that in order to understand emptiness, in order to understand egolessness or selflessness from the Buddhist point of view, you first have to really find the self as you understand it, as you experience it within your own subjective reality. You have to locate that sense of self and really explore it in order to kind of grasp its groundlessness. In order to see through it, you first have to find it as you actually experience it. So he showed me how in Tibetan Buddhism in particular, they have this idea of what they call injured innocence. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone you love accuses you of doing something that you really didn't do, you know, that hurt their feelings badly, and you have that sense that wells up inside of you of, you know, how could they accuse me of that? And I didn't do that. You know, that's the kind of an easy way to find the self that you believe in that really doesn't exist in the way you believe it. from the Buddhist point of view. Mm-hmm. So that kind of subtlety has inspired me, you know, because a lot of patients who come to therapy are often holding that place, you know, of injured innocence where they have been hurt in various ways and where they don't really deserve it. But then that sense of self, the ego that is defending itself, you know, all the time coalesces around some of that mistreatment and then gets in the way of a kind of deeper understanding of what the self is capable of in terms of love and forgiveness and understanding and so on. So I've been inspired in some way by all of that.
Mm. And do you find the ego now as something that you have to, let's say, conquer, or is it more of a friend?
Well, I see it more as an obscuration. Often, okay. The ego is a kind of obscuration that, from one angle, you have to be able to see through. From another angle, you have to be able to tame or harness. I would say harness its energies for the purposes of cultivating, you know, what the Buddhists usually in a shorthand call wisdom or compassion. Wisdom and compassion. So even mindfulness, which has become, you know, kind of very popular and instrumental, yeah, yeah, even within the psychotherapy world, mindfulness, the cultivation of mindfulness is really a kind of ego function, you know, where you're getting the ego to observe itself.
Yeah.
That self-observation, that self-reflection, mm, the harnessing of that ability to observe or witness, that's an ego function. That's a classic ego function, even from a Western psychoanalytic point of view. That it's a sort of therapeutic split in the ego, that psychoanalysis from the beginning was trying to harness that same ability in free association and whatnot. So to be able to see mindfulness as an ego function, I think helps people not try to leapfrog over themselves and just, surrender to what Freud called the oceanic feeling. I don't think that's that sort of floating in the bliss of the unconscious isn't the be-all and end-all of the Buddhist spiritual path.
Mm-hmm. You've written a little bit about doing and being, and I'm afraid I haven't done enough research into your writing to understand exactly what you meant. But is the doing the ego?
That dialectic between doing and being,
yeah,
I got a lot from a famous British child analyst named Donald Winnicott,
okay,
who was the person who popularized the phrase of the good enough mother or the good enough parent. And his idea was that a child from a very young age has to have both experiences of doing and of being. That the performative aspect or the learning aspect, the learning how to walk, learning how to read, learning how to sing, learning all the skills that one needs to become a coherent a person in the world, that's a lot of doing. And a lot of our education is about that. But Winnicott talked about how the parents, in his view, the mother in the 50s, but we expand it now to include the parents of both genders. The parents have another task, which is to make a safe enough environment for a child so that they don't all the time have to be performing, so that they can relax into play, into their imagination. Winnicott talked a lot about the parent being safely in the next room, so that the child knows that the mother or the father is there, but they don't have to be like checking all the time that the parent is there. So they can then have a different kind of experience, which he called being. which involved play, which involved fantasy, which involved imagination, which he said grew into art and culture and religion as one gets older. So I've always seen meditation in particular as a kind of return to or a cultivation of that capacity for being. And you asked, is that ego or not ego? Again, I would say in meditation, that's ego being used to kind of put the ego into neutral so that this capacity for play, for what Winnicott called a transitional experiencing. He was into the teddy bear, you know, that gives the 2-year-old, the 3-year-old child a sense of safety or comfort or holding. There's this idea of creating a holding environment for yourself in meditation that returns the capacity for being. I think plugs into when you read Zen poetry and so on. That's all about the kind of beingness or thusness that's there in nature that we experience when we quiet our own minds. I think that's one way that those two worlds link up for me.
I'm a bit of a fan of research into near-death experiences and curious about past life regression and psychics, and you seem to have a bit of a curiosity too. I was listening to your session with psychic medium Laura Lynn Jackson, author of Communicating with Our Past Selves.
Oh, yeah, you listened to that.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering if you're scared you might have crossed the Buddhist line with all of that.
I might have crossed a Western a scientific psychoanalytic line with all of that.
Okay.
There's a big debate within Buddhism, you know, about whether to whether it's necessary to think about past lives or consciousness persisting beyond death, whether that is intrinsic to Buddhist thought, as someone like Robert Thurman would argue, or whether that's cultural baggage, as someone like Stephen Batchelor might argue. And I can take either position because I really don't know. But I was very touched, as I think you could hear in that conversation with Laura Lynn Jackson, by her personal experience of the threshold between this world and other worlds being so thin, and her ability psychically to have access to beings who seem to exist on the other side of that scrim. I had a very personal reading with her after my own father died of a brain tumor, where she right away had my father there with her, and she had no knowledge of him or of my final conversation with him before he died. But she right away had my father picking up on the last conversation and reassuring me that something I had said to him before he died was actually what his experience was after, you know, during his death. So, I shared some of that in that conversation at the Rubin Museum with her, the public conversation. So that's been a very nice added element to my personal life, that connection that I have with her and via her with my father.
Yeah, and I was particularly touched and amused by your father's words of, "Okay, darling, I'll give it a try," or something like that.
Yeah, I was trying to counsel him. I had never. My father was a physician and a scientist who kind of put up with my interest in Buddhism and was proud of my writing and glad I became a doctor, but never really wanted to talk about anything spiritual. He didn't. He was a scientist, and he thought when he died, it was all going to be over, you know?
Yeah.
But then he came down with a brain tumor on the silent part of his brain, so he was all there cognitively but knew he was going to die. And I realized I'd never talked to him about anything spiritual and decided I would try. So I had this one conversation where I tried to talk to him about what the Buddhists say about what to do when you're dying. which was to try to sort of fall back or relax your mind, as we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, relax your mind into the place where you are, who you've always been, where inside, you know, you feel, you, whether you're 20 or 30 or 40 or 80, you still feel the same to yourself. And I suggested that that's the place to take refuge as the body falls away. And he said to me very kindly, you know, okay, darling, I'll try. So then when I, when I had the reading with Laura Lynn Jackson, as a prelude to my public conversation with her, this is, you know, 3 years after my father died and 5 years before this conversation that you listened to, the first thing she said was, oh, your father's here. He says to tell you that you were right. And I was like, oh, my God, finally my father's telling me I was right about something. You know? So, and then he said through her, I thought I was smart before, but where I am now, I'm really smart. Now when I need to know something, I just have to think it, and then I know it. And that was, that sounded so much the pride my father had in his intelligence. It just sounded so much still like him that in that moment, I had no doubt that it was him.
Isn't that gorgeous? Yeah, it's lovely.
It was a very nice moment for me.
I won't go into how...
In the aftermath of that, I could question it and so on. But, yes, you won't go into it?
I was just going to say, it's so resonant with me. My father was an accountant and had very, very similar experience at the end. But anyway, I wondered, have you decided to go more down that way? Have you thought of going into hypnosis or past life regression with any of your patients or yourself?
No, I don't think I'm built that way.
Okay.
I always thought I would learn hypnosis because it was so close to meditation, but I never found anyone I trusted enough to learn from. And then I've just sort of settled into my own mode of working. So, and I don't think I think I'm too. I don't know, structured in my own way that the past life regression, I've known people who could do that, either experience it for themselves or guide people that way, but I don't think I'm really either. So I'm just, I feel very lucky, like that connection with Laura Lynn has served its purpose, and some of my patients who are oriented that way, who I think it might help, I've encouraged to have them meet with her, and they sometimes have shared what they've gotten from her with me. So I've gone down that path a little bit more, but that's certainly not right for everybody, and I wouldn't push it on anybody.
You've written also that the willingness to face traumas, be they large, small, primitive, or fresh, is the key to healing from them. They may never disappear in the way we think they should, but maybe they don't need to. Trauma is an radical aspect of life. We are human as a result of it, not in spite of it. Is facing trauma a little bit like facing our fears? Do we have to sit with trauma so that we're not paralyzed and we actually hear its message?
Yeah, I believe that. I mean, I think that's what therapy is all about. And I think often that's what meditation is about. And there's different kinds of trauma, you know. There's the huge traumas, like the World Trade Center blowing up and the tsunami in Southeast Asia. And I've had people come to me affected by those kinds of things. And then there are the little traumas that occur when we're really young and we're just, you know, maybe nothing happened when something profitable should have. And those are traumas, too. But I think that's what unifies us as human beings. We're all subject to that one way or another. Death and old age and illness and loss is going to affect all of us if it hasn't already. So I think we don't have to think about trauma as a huge thing that happens to other people that's sort of outside of our understanding. We can meet it in ourselves and in our friends and in the culture. We can meet it with openness and even love, you know, and understanding, because it's universal, really. So
that's lovely.
I think my work has brought me into that kind of appreciation, which for me seems true.
You say we are a human as a result of trauma, but are we really ultimately human? Does our connection with each other make us actually much more than human? Do we have to accept that we have to have trauma, that we have to suffer, that we have to be finite, that we have to be egos, I guess?
Well, that's the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, you know, where he starts out with trauma. That's the first noble truth. Dukkha literally means hard to face. Ka is face. Dukkha is like difficult to face. So he's saying there's something, and then he goes into it, you know, old age, illness, death, loss, separation from those we love, being having to be close to people we don't love, you know. All of that is trauma. All of that is dukkha. All of that's hard to face. But then he says that's only the first truth, you know, and that there's the third truth also, which is that just as there is dukkha, just as there is trauma, there is also liberation from trauma and nirvana. You know, which means there's a blissful, almost orgasmic underlying reality, you know, that we can't see because of the obscuration of ego. We can't see that because we're so affected by the trauma. You know, we're dissociating ourselves, trying not to see the traumatic aspect, that stops us also from seeing the blissful aspect. And the blissful aspect actually shines through when we stop pretending that the traumatic aspect isn't there. There's some way that the two are linked like that. So you know, that, and that's the Buddhist vision. So I have bought into that vision, and you know, I'm trying to hold that dual reality, which the Buddha says is really one reality.
Well, I'll just finish with this last quote of yours, which probably wraps that up, which was, happiness comes from letting go. In Buddhism, the impenetrable, separate, and individuated self is more the problem than the solution.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's the problem with that quote, the separated, individuated self, it is necessary. We do all have to travel that path. If we don't, we just end up, you know, psychotic or a drug addicted or something. So that is something that we all need. It just doesn't have to be the end point. It needn't be the end point. It's a stuck place if it becomes the end point. As part of the journey, it can take us beyond that separated, individuated place, which has a lot of suffering in it. But it can't be avoided either. You know, it's a necessary platform, I think, for something greater or something lesser, however you want to see it.
Well, for me, and you know, I don't want to talk too much about my own opinion, but for me, this letting go is, you know, a letting go of the idea that we are separate, you know, and that happiness for me comes from love connecting us, you know, and a sense of connection, you know, via community or whatever else, for me is what brings happiness to my life. Is that something?
I totally agree, except that I think the sense of separateness is something, there's some truth there also that shouldn't be just, you know, try that shouldn't be eliminated. We are each individual beings. Our own consciousness is unique in a certain way. We're special, each one of us, in our own particular way. And the separation and connection, that dialectic, that dichotomy, that we oscillate between being a particle and a wave, you know, between being a separate being and part of the whole. I, that mystery is, I think, a compelling one, and one that we all have to deal with. So, you know, that's more where I'm coming from.
That's lovely. I like the particle and wave. Mark, thanks so much for giving me your time. It's been 30 minutes and I'm really grateful. I don't want to hold you up anymore, but thank you so much for your time. And you really are wonderful to talk to, I must say. You just take that on the chin or whatever, but you have a lovely, lovely way of speaking.
Well, you're very welcome, and this has been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for your deeply felt questions.
Oh, good on you. That's very nice of you.
To find out more about Mark Epstein, please go to his website, markepsteinmd.com.